The Anesthesia Podcast.
Welcome to the May edition of the Anesthesia Journal Podcast. My name is Marianne Turner and I'm an editor at Anesthesia. I'm recording from the unceded lands of the Boonwurrung people of the Kulin Nation. I acknowledge their elders past and present and I extend that respect to our Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander listeners. I'm delighted today to be joined by Dr. Mike Charlesworth, who is both an editor and the dissemination editor of Anesthesia Journal. Mike, I think the last time we caught up was in a Japanese restaurant in Sydney Harbour last year.
We did indeed, and the sun was shining and the sky was blue and the food was great and the company was awesome as well. So it was really good memories.
Absolutely. No, it was absolutely wonderful to see you face to face then, and great to catch up again today. Thank you for agreeing to be in the hot seat for our May podcast. I know that you're normally on the other side of the microphone, so to speak. How are you feeling?
Terrified, like I'm about to be vivid, but that's okay because I think it's I've done this to enough people now that it should be my turn, definitely.
It's coming back. Now, Mike, yeah. I'm sure most of our listeners are familiar with your background and experience, but for any newcomers to the podcast, can you tell us a bit about yourself?
Yeah, so I'm a cardiokinesist based in Manchester. I've been a consultant for about 5 years now. I was trainee fellow with the journal a good number of years ago, and I want that to sort of show the importance we place on the trainee fellowship at the journal, because we have lots of editors now who have been through that process. So if you're a trainee and you're really interested in becoming an editor at the journal, it's a really good way of making yourselves known to us and working with us, and then hopefully coming to join us full time as an editor. We place an awful lot of importance on that. I've been an editor of the journal for about 6 years, and as well as editing papers, etc., like an editor would do, I've been tasked with leading the social media strategy and dissemination strategy, which is something that's really interested me for a long time, using Twitter, using all the other platforms and this format as well, which is fairly new in terms of podcasts, to try and get messages from the paper out there and try and reach people where they are. And it's been really good to get you involved with that recently, Marianne, and to show you the ropes, because you've been tweeting recently and it's been amazing seeing someone else do it and someone else doing it even better than me. So it's been really good.
Oh, not at all, Mike. Thank you for letting me be part of the team. you must have seen social media change so much over the years that you've been involved. Can you tell us a bit about any changes that you've noticed?
Yeah, there's been a lot of changes. If you would have told me in 2018 that Elon Musk was going to buy Twitter and it was going to be called X, I'd probably tell you to tell me another one. And I think we use all the platforms in a very different way now. A lot of us don't engage with Twitter as much as we perhaps used to. Some of us use it to lurk and watch rather than engage, because we're worried that something we're going to say might be taken the wrong way, for example. So you can't be too controversial in 2024 on Twitter, unfortunately. It's not the place to have those really complex discussions as it used to be 5 years or so ago. But I think this format in terms of podcasts and live author interviews and multi-platform, multimedia streaming is definitely the future of this type of work, where we try and give people the messages behind a paper. And it wouldn't surprise me in 5 years' time if podcasts and videos were what people used for their CPD, instead of in the past where we used to use tweet chats and we used to look at tweets of interesting papers, etc. I think in the future it'll be videos, and it'll be hearing from authors and hearing from editors and hearing from experts as well, and us using that and interacting with that in order to get our CPD.
Yeah, I mean, I think there's definitely been a generational shift in how people choose to consume content. And I wonder whether our attention span is maybe a little shorter these days.
Yeah, so I would agree with that, absolutely.
You know, these shorter kind of ways of disseminating all of the amazing, you know, findings that we publish are a really effective way of reaching a wider population. Now, you've chosen three papers for us to go through today, Mike. So let's launch right into that. The first paper is entitled Risk Factors for Complications After Emergency Surgery for Pediatric Appendicitis, a National Prospective Observational Cohort Study. The authors on the paper are all UK-based and included the Children's Acute Surgical Abdomen Program, or CASAP, investigators. Can you give our listeners a quick outline of this paper and how you were involved?
Yes, I was very privileged to be the handling editor for this paper, and I started working on it with the authors around the middle of last year, and it was published in February, I think, of this year, and it's in the May issue. So it's been really great to see it come through. It's a fascinating paper because I don't need to ask children anymore, but when I did when I was a trainee, a common operation was appendicitis, and we saw lots of children for appendectomy. And I had this assumption that it was quite a basic condition. A child would come in with appendicitis and receive a diagnosis, and whether or not they had treatment with an operation or something else, and the outcomes would be kind of similar for most children. But this large study, which is a prospective observational study, really challenges that and really asks some difficult questions about differential outcomes based on ethnicity. For me, to see that outcome is very much related to the ethnicity of a child, it's very difficult reading, I guess, for a lot of people. Although the paper doesn't really go as far to give us the reasons behind that, and I think that will take lots of inquiry in the future, it suggests that there is health inequality within a publicly funded healthcare system. And these sorts of papers have been released before in North America and show differential outcomes based on ethnicity in systems that are funded very differently. But to see something like this in the UK NHS is very worrying indeed.
Now, Mike, how do we know about so basically what they found was that it was ethnicity and not socioeconomic status that was associated with an increased risk of postoperative complications. How do we know the socioeconomic status of children?
Well, in the UK, it's actually relatively easy to determine socioeconomic status based on where you live. So we have this scale called an index of deprivation scale, which you can use in all the countries of the UK, and you can correct that. So you get an area that's the least deprived and an area that's the most deprived, and then the areas all in between.
And given that ethnicity was found to be a risk factor, I found it interesting that one of the exclusion criteria were children with non-English speaking legal guardians. What effect do you think that may have had on the outcomes? Should these children have been included as well?
Yeah, that's fascinating because that obviously has brought some bias into the outcomes. So that's the first thing. The second thing is, and this was obviously done for logistical reasons in terms of recruiting and getting the patients recruited. I think what we want to do in the future is to try and remove that barrier from recruitment so that we're able to recruit a more diverse population of patients into studies like this. And I think probably in the future, with more funding, now that we have this paper which has generated this particular hypothesis, and we'll probably go on to have more analyses related to this, that will be a barrier that will come down, I guess, in the future. And we've seen time and time again that the more effort and the more funding we can get to include a more diverse population of patients, that everyone benefits from that. The patients benefit from it because they're more likely to have a better outcome if they're involved in research, and the research is improved as well. But we know, because we've seen this time and again, that patients recruited into studies tend to look more like the people who are doing the research rather than the population as a whole. And that's something that is changing at the moment.
Yeah, definitely. I think there's been an increased focus on gender in recruitment as well. So I think it's happening across the board, which is wonderful to see. Now, one of the interesting things that I found about this study was where the source of the funding. So the paper was funded by the Royal College, or the study was funded by the Royal College of Anaesthetists, but the primary outcome was essentially a surgical complication. Where are the surgeons in this study? Were there surgeons involved?
Yeah, so there were surgeons involved on the authorship in this study, and it was really collaborative in terms of the authorship of the paper. And the lead author actually is coming to Harrogate to present this paper and some of the issues around it in a session which is about the influence of patient demographics on outcomes. So that'd be a really, really good session on the Friday morning of the annual Congress. So yeah, there was the appropriate representation on the authorship. And I think that speaks to a wider point, which is that we need do need to come out of our silos. And probably as an anaesthetist, I should be reading surgical journals as well. I'm a cardiac anaesthetist. I should probably, from time to time, have a look at what's going on in the literature in cardiac surgery, because that's really relevant to my practice. And I don't do enough of that as I probably should do. And vice versa, this surgeon should probably have a look in our journals as well. And not just that, they should probably publish in one of his journals. And as this paper has shown a really good example of, we should probably have not just all anaesthetists contributing to a paper on perioperative medicine. We should have a mix of surgeons and anaesthetists. And we had a really good paper in the supplement this year, which was about surgical aspects of sustainability by a group of surgeons from Birmingham who are on fire at the moment in terms of the output that they're producing. And that was a really nice paper. And a good few years ago now, we had a collaboration with the British Journal of Surgery where we co-published a supplement in one of his journals. And I think that sort of collaboration is between us and surgeons and between anaesthetists and critical care physicians and gynecologists and orthopedic surgeons and you name it. I think we do need to probably work more with one another in our academic outputs than probably we do now. And this paper is a really good example of that.
And I think we can only get better outcomes, right, if we all work in a more multidisciplinary type fashion moving forward, because everybody brings a different perspective to the table.
Yeah, we should all train together. We should all perform research together. We should all write together. And there should be much more multidisciplinary focus, because that is the way that we deliver care to patients.
Yeah, absolutely. And I mean, so we're not surgeons, but one of the other things that I sort of noted in the paper was that 13% of children who had surgery were found to have a normal appendix. If 10,000 children have appendectomies in the UK annually, this is potentially a lot of children who are having surgery that, you know, may not require surgery. Is this something that you found concerning or that the group commented on?
As a matter of fact, we were just talking then about reading one another's journals, and I've actually read a paper from a surgical group who actually looked into this, and it's fascinating. And there's two papers and two groups, actually. One was about five conditions and whether or not surgery modified outcome in those conditions. So, for example, small bowel obstruction. Does an operation for small bowel obstruction always give a better outcome than conservative management? And that's been done with appendicitis as well. And I think more recently, the same group who I mentioned from Birmingham, who related to the STAR Surge and COVID Surge group that published with us, they've actually looked at that and looked at outcomes with appendicitis, whether or not the patients have an operation.
Now, I might move on now from pediatric appendectomy to perioperative anaphylaxis. So we recently published the Resuscitation Council UK algorithm for anaesthetists on the emergency treatment of perioperative anaphylaxis. This came out of work done by the UK Perioperative Allergy Network. The authorship of the paper is quite illustrious and includes Louise Savick, one of our editors with a clinical interest in allergy, as well as Jasmeet Saw, who's a NAP7 clinical lead and has been on several of our previous podcasts talking about the NAP7 outcomes. NAP6 looked at perioperative anaphylaxis, and their findings were published in May 2018. And yet, only now are we publishing a perioperative anaphylaxis guideline in 2024. What do you think has what's the time frame behind this? Do you have any ideas about why this has taken this time?
Yeah, that's really interesting, and that just shows the maybe one of the reasons is a lag between evidence that's generated. And NAP6 was important, and there's been a lot of other studies as well that are relevant in that time. And when these guidelines come around as well, which can sometimes take a good long time to put together and to agree and to write. What was fascinating during COVID was the airway guidelines, which is something that would normally take years to produce, and they were produced rapidly, and they were really excellent guidelines. And I think they're one of our most cited ever papers now, and we all used them during the pandemic. I think there have been other guidelines in the interim. So there were some Resuscitation Council UK guidelines 3 years ago. Mm. What's different about this paper is that it focused specifically on management for the anaesthetist. And I think that's very different for management of anaphylaxis more generally, and especially Absolutely. In the perioperative period. Because most of us, if we are faced with anaphylaxis, which we hope we're not, but the chances are we probably will at least once in our career. I've had a few anaphylaxis, unfortunately. I've probably been unlucky. And it's very scary, and it's really good to know how to manage it when it does happen. This is really great because it tells us and probably reinforces what most of us do already, which is to give smaller doses of adrenaline in titrated increments rather than giving something intramuscularly and rather than giving a really big dose intravenously. We know that adrenaline is very toxic when it's given in a very high dose, and it can cause all sorts of complications. And that's what actually NAP7 found, is that practices around adrenaline administration during perioperative cardiac arrest were very haphazard sometimes. And adrenaline was sometimes used in very, very strange doses and strange routes. And I think this brings together evidence, but also expert opinion. Other guidelines as well are brought in. And I think what they suggest in the end is very sensible, which is an initial dose of 50 micrograms. And there's some suggestions for children as well, as smaller doses, 10 to 50 micrograms, how to give fluids as well as the adrenaline. And then what to do if the adrenaline, if the anaphylaxis persists, and how to use the adrenaline infusion, which should be a low dose adrenaline infusion. It also gives guidance about when to start CPR, and that's something that's come from NAP7 as well. So, I mean, you could argue on the one side that NAP6 was a while ago and this is only coming now, or you could, on the other hand, argue, well, NAP7 was only just published recently, and there was an anaphylaxis paper during NAP7, and some of the recommendations here are quite similar to that as well. I think the two groups are very, very different, so it's different clinicians involved with that. As anaesthetist, we'll probably find this a lot more useful than that 2021 update a few years ago.
Absolutely. I think this one, you know, with the use of intravenous adrenaline, you know, that's something that's, you know, really quite different in an operating theatre environment as opposed to in a hospital or community setting. Mike, this paper was really popular on Twitter.
It was, wasn't it?
Like some read. Yeah.
Do you know, the weird thing was as well, is that papers normally only get one go. So normally you only get a really good hit on the first go, and then you tweet it again a few weeks or months later, and then no one's all that interested. Whereas every time this paper's been tweeted, which has been a few times, people love it. And you'd rarely see that in a paper, actually.
Yeah, do you have any thoughts behind why it is so popular?
Yeah, it ticks a lot of boxes. The first is that, as I mentioned before, anaphylaxis, when it does happen, it's very scary, and we all want to know how to treat it. And if someone wants to update me about how to manage that, I want to know it. And I think a lot of others shared it in a very helpful way to try and say, actually, this is really important and you should probably know about it. There's that. There's also the fact that the guidelines are really useful clinically. They're very pragmatic. I can pick this up and I can use that straight away. And the final thing, and this is really, really important, you know, normally me and you would make our infographics for papers to try and get some attraction. But we didn't need to do that for this paper, because the algorithm is, there's no other way of describing it than it is simply beautiful. It really is. It's perfect. The use of colours, how simple it is, how usable it is. I don't know if you saw recently, and I can't remember where it was published or which bodies were behind it, but there were some airway guidelines from somewhere in America, I think, and they were really unusable. There was arrows going all over the place. There was, you know, you don't want that sort of complex information when you're trying to deal with an emergency. Whereas this algorithm that's in red, it shows that this is really critical, is really, really easy to follow. And you can pick that up, you can scan the QR code and have that on your phone, and you can manage a patient with that perfectly. And I think people shared this paper for that reason as well. So no, well done to the authors for Resuscitation Council UK for producing that, because that brings every single point of the paper together and provides a really nice summary and a really pleasing way to the eye.
I mean, good quality cognitive aids are so important in, you know, especially in crisis situations. Certainly in Australia and New Zealand, we have, you know, most operating theatres have a printed out laminated copy of our cognitive aid for anaphylaxis. So that if you do have an anaphylaxis, we call immediately for our anaphylaxis box, and that laminated card comes straight out and everybody knows what needs to be done. Do you foresee this cognitive aid being used in a similar way in the UK?
Yeah, absolutely. This needs printing out and putting in every single theatre and anaesthetic room. And like you said as well, putting with the grab bag for anaphylaxis as well. It's just so clinically useful and accessible. This will probably be a paper that we'll be talking about for a long time, I think. And congratulations to the authors on producing it. It's really excellent.
Certainly, we've already had some correspondence from Yang and others out of the National Taiwan University Hospital who've noted that they believe that end-tidal carbon dioxide monitoring in the diagnosis of anaphylaxis warrants greater emphasis in the guideline. Do you think that we'll see future iterations of this guideline? And what are your thoughts on the inclusion of end-tidal carbon dioxide monitoring in anaphylaxis?
That's really interesting because I've never really thought about end-tidal carbon dioxide use before for anaphylaxis. We always, there's a big focus on it now for airway management.
Absolutely, yes.
To confirm the tube is in the correct place and not in the incorrect place, we use exhaled carbon dioxide and it has to be sustained over a period of time. And certainly that's one of the things that came out of the PUMA guideline. But I've never really thought about it before for anaphylaxis. And the letter actually makes a lot of sense. And notice that the authors haven't responded to that yet. And I think it'd be really good to see their response and see if that's something they would consider in future iterations. So the power of correspondence is definitely something, because you can read a guideline like this and you can look at it from a different perspective and you can put it to the authors. And before you know it, your suggestion may well end up in future iterations and cited as such as well. So please do send us your letters, because we really do value them.
Oh, it's invaluable, isn't it? And hearing from our colleagues from all over the world come up with all these other, you know, things that, you know, are equally potentially worthy of inclusion in these papers. So the next and last paper that I wanted to discuss, Mike, is how to conduct and report guidelines and position best practice and consensus statements. This paper is co-authored by our Big Cheese editor-in-chief, Matt Wise, our senior editor, Kareem L. Bogdudley, and our US-based editor, Ed Mariano.
Yeah, well, name a better trio.
I know. And I mean, this isn't the first time that anaesthesia editors have written a paper, like essentially describing how to write a paper. Is this a common thing for journal editors to do?
We would regularly write papers like this. We've gone through quite a lot of different series of articles. So we've had previously statistically speaking articles, which are all about statistics. And we used to get our statistics editor to write those, but also the editors would write them. And JD Pandit would write them regularly as well. And we've had clinical consequences where we've discussed very clinical aspects of previously published papers. And this is part of a series called Reviewer Recommendations, where we've looked at the methods behind the paper. And for example, if you were going to write a narrative review and submit it to anaesthesia, there's a much higher chance that you're going to get that review submitted if you've read the reviewer recommendations for that type of method. And there's one for pilot studies, and there's one for guidelines, as here, there's one for a meta-analysis, there's one for Bayesian statistics. If you can think of a particular method for a paper, we've got a guide that we've published and written. So it's really useful because you're much more likely to get your work accepted. But also, there are very educational aspects to them as well. So even if you're not using this as an author, you can read and understand the background behind a particular method. And for this particular paper, you can understand how authors will put together consensus statements, guidelines, and position statements, and work out what the difference is between those types of studies.
Absolutely. I find these papers incredibly helpful, both as someone who writes papers and also as someone who reads a lot of papers. So I think they're incredibly useful. I guess the question is, how do you think that the anaphylaxis guideline stacks up to the paper? Do you think that it ticks all the boxes?
I'm not entirely sure which category the anaphylaxis paper falls into. I don't think it's a guideline, because it's not a systematic review based on evidence with recommendations from that. There is some expert opinion involved. There are practice recommendations which are based on very difficult areas of clinical practice, which aren't going to be able to be answered by high-level evidence. So it's quite difficult, really. I would say the anaphylaxis paper is more of an algorithm that's been produced by Resuscitation UK that is based on evidence, but also based on expert opinion as well. I wouldn't say it's a consensus statement. It's an algorithm with clinical recommendations, much like a lot of the other resuscitation guidelines as such are. I think what's important about the review recommendations paper is it does split into three of the types of papers we normally see. And the more sort of pure guidelines that we would have are things like PUMA. So if you to read the PUMA guideline, that is a textbook guideline. It's a systematic review that the authors have spent years doing, and that's been brought together to produce a guideline. If you look at a position statement, you could look at the position statement on equity, diversity and inclusion amongst the anaesthesia editors, because that's very much stating the working practices and the position of the anaesthesia editors on certain topics related to EDI. And if you were to look at a consensus statement, I would refer you probably to the steroid consensus statement we'd have on steroids in the perioperative period, which is very popular. And those are three papers to show us that probably show better the difference between those types of papers.
Absolutely. We'll encourage all of our readers to go and check all of those out. Yep. So, Mike, the Viva is complete.
How did I do, Marianne? Was it okay?
Oh, 5 stars. How are you feeling?
No, it's really, it's great to do this, to try and bring out those messages from the papers. And I think it's really important part of our role as editors to do that and to communicate with clinicians as well. And I really hope that the outcome from that is that people who are listening along at home will find something that they're interested in that's related to these papers and delve a little bit deeper into them. And that may generate discussions in the workplace. It may spark a journal club discussion. It may even spark a letter of correspondence. And it's all about engaging with a paper and making it as interactive as possible and bringing it to life and not just being something that's a PDF on a website. It's much more than that. And I hope that that's what these podcasts achieve in the future.
Excellent. And just to reiterate, we do encourage everybody to write in to us and to get involved in the discussion on social media. We love to hear from everybody. So please reach out, get involved. I think we've all got lots to learn from all of these amazing papers. Mike, thank you so much for your time today.
Thank you as well.
And for agreeing to be in the hot seat. and I encourage all of our readers to get on board and download the May edition and have a read through. There's a paper there for everybody, I'm sure. Thanks again.
Thank you very much. Goodbye.
Bye.
The Anaesthesia Podcast.